That's Jason Rosenbaum with PCCC, Bold Progressives. Also on the phone with us, we have Maria Freese, who is Director of Government Relations and Policy at the National Committee to Preserve Social Security. Good afternoon to you, Maria.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Well, you tell me, why would the National Committee to Preserve Social Security be engaged in this particular debate over tax deals?
Well, aside from the fact, of course, that any increase in the deficit hurts Social Security and Medicare, we actually fight to preserve both programs. And in fact, if you're watching the Deficit Commission lately, you know that they went square after Social Security and Medicare as part of their deficit reduction.
So which, in fact, should not have been part of their purview, but
exactly.
Never mind.
Certainly not Social Security. So clearly, any increase in the deficit is problematic for us. But more importantly, most people don't realize yet there is a payroll tax holiday in this plan that is the beginning of the end of Social Security as we know it.
Well, and this has been touted as one of the gains that Mr.
Yes.
Obama gained from
Yes.
from the Republicans.
I understand that. And unfortunately, this is something that has been touted by a number of Republicans over the years as a way of starving the Social Security program of resources. I think Mr. Obama listened to his economists who talked about the stimulative impact of putting money in people's pockets. We are all for putting money in people's pockets, but there are a lot of better ways of doing it than cutting the payroll tax. One perfect reason to understand this is the tax package itself. All of the Bush tax cuts that we're now fighting over were intended to be temporary. And look how hard it is for Congress to agree to put those rates back up where they were supposed to be. How on earth do you really expect a more conservative Congress next year at the beginning of a new campaign cycle to restore what is going to be portrayed by the Republicans as a 50% increase in your payroll tax? Because that's what it's going to be. A 2% payroll tax is 50% of the 4% you're going to be paying once they shrink it. So I can see the ads now. Your payroll taxes are going to go up by 50%. Oh, and by the way, you don't get any additional benefits at retirement because of this. So you're just throwing your money away. And I don't see how the payroll tax, this temporary cut ever stays temporary. And the Republicans have made no bones about the fact in the last day or two that this is a great thing for them, because it's going to force Congress to cut the program because it won't have enough resources to continue.
Now, explain the connection there. Payroll tax and Social Security, many people will not put those two in the same sentence in their minds.
Social Security is paid for by a payroll tax. That's what it does. The FICA tax, the payroll tax that you pay with every single paycheck that you earn, has a little portion of it that goes into Social Security. A portion goes into Social Security, a portion goes into Medicare. That is your contribution to the program, and when you get ready to retire, your benefits are calculated based on what you contributed during your lifetime and what your lifetime earnings were. Once this payroll tax gets lowered, you're now going to have to fill that gap, at least for a while, with general tax revenues. So suddenly this dedicated money is going to have to compete with every other priority of the government. And part of the reason that American families don't have enough saved in their pension plans, their 401k plans, or their IRAs is because when retirement money has to compete with the expenses of daily living, retirement always loses. So it won't take long before this temporary payroll tax cut turns into a permanent tax cut that then turns into a cut in Social Security benefits across the board. It is the first, it is a wonderful opportunity for those people who have never supported Social Security in the first place to get to force dramatic cuts in Social Security in future years.
Hmm. And of course,
and
that is what Mr.
Apparently, the president doesn't understand that, which is very unfortunate.
Yeah, as smart as I believe him to be, because that is one of the things he was talking about in his statement we played at the beginning of the program. Well, we've got 2 years and we're going to be talking about this, and I'm confident that they'll see that when they see what kind of cuts we have to make. And I thought, wait a minute, hold it right there. Then they'll be sorry. So you're listening to Maria Fries, Government Relations and Policy Director for the National Committee to Preserve Social Security. And I see that you guys are having a press conference call tomorrow on this topic. What can people listening do about this? And what hope do you have? Everyone's saying it's going to pass, no problem.
Well, unfortunately, that's probably the case because the president wants it and a lot of people don't understand it, and the Republicans are going to vote for it. So there may be some tweaking in the next day or so to try to persuade more of the House Democrats to get on board. I cannot imagine that the payroll tax is going to be one of those things that's going to change. So I don't know what we do other than try to educate people as much as possible so that at the end of the year when this thing does come up for reconsideration, we might be able to perhaps persuade enough people to go ahead and let the cut expire. But frankly,
the end of 2 years, you mean?
Well, it's a one-year cut right now. There's no way at the end of this year that they're actually going to let it lapse, because at that point it's the beginning of a new campaign cycle, and all of the economists say that the unemployment rate's not going to be a whole lot better than it is right now. So again, we'll be facing having to extend it for at least one more year, simply because of the fact that it's going to be a bad time to try to replace it. And then the year after that, there'll be some other reason. And the year after that, there'll be some other reason. Every year, it's very easy to enact a tax cut. It is extremely difficult to let a tax cut expire.
Maria,
and this is nothing but a tax cut.
Maria Fries, stay with us on the line. We're also joined by yet another element of this conversation. And this is the folks that many people have been blaming, including, let's see, I'm looking for this piece that I just saw because it was written so well. Lots of folks write op-ed pieces about how all the wealthiest Americans are the ones that are going to benefit from this, and that, in fact, this is the problem, that over the years our government has become more and more hostage, thanks first to the Reagan tax and then tax cuts and then on through the Bush tax cuts, that the very, very wealthy in this country have become the government. And there is no way, just as Maria was just saying, that any of the rest of us have got a chance. There is a group that is sort of swimming upstream on this one, and this is called, there are two of them, Wealth for the Common Good, Patriotic Millionaires for Fiscal Strength, et cetera, et cetera. And we have a gentleman joining us from Wealth for the Common Good, and that is Jeff Hayes, and he's president of Stratilus Research in Washington. Good afternoon to you, sir.
Good to be with you.
So you're a betrayer of your class, is that it?
Exactly. I'm the token rich guy here who's basically has a sense of fairness, which I think a lot of people who have done very well over the last decade don't seem to have very much. I mean, you know, for me, joining this organization was sort of thinking about the good fortune that I've had over about, you know, the last 10 years or so, and thinking about the way in which sort of income inequality has changed across the country. I mean, 30 years ago, the top 1% were taking home about, you know, 10% of the total national income. And now it's about three times that amount for, you know, for us sort of rich folks. So it's really a question of kind of what kind of country do you want to live in? And this isn't the kind of country that I want to live in.
Now, the spokesperson for Wealth for the Common Good, who is Alison Goldberg, identified in the press release that Wealth for the Common Good put out. And actually, you can go to wealthforcommongood.org for more information. She says, "We're alarmed that President Obama is compromising on high-income tax cuts." Where does the alarm come in? Rather than you were just saying, well, it, to be fair, basically, was your message. What about alarm? What would be frightening about it?
Well, from the perspective of a small business owner, my alarm comes from a misdiagnosis of the problems that we're currently facing in the economy. I mean, tax cuts for the rich are kind of all well and good, but really that's not my problem. My problem is weak demand across the economy. And these kind of tax cuts are an incredibly inefficient way to stimulate broader demand in the economy. I mean, infrastructure spending, other sort of large government programs, would be a much, much better way, basically sort of, you know, sort of supercharge kind of, you know, the demand for, you know, the services that my kind of company is providing.
Demand, so, you mean consumer shopping?
Exactly.
Basically, yeah.
In my case, a little different, but it doesn't really matter.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing. So
yeah,
so,
people buying things.
Right, precisely, which, you know, rich people, they buy some stuff, but they don't buy as much, you know, stuff with the money that is provided in the form of these tax cuts.
Well, another member of this group said, when Main Street consumers are doing better, we all will do better. And this gentleman is CEO of a home furnishings business, so he's got more of a direct consumer product that he's talking about than perhaps you do. But he says, while my tax rate was higher 10 years ago, I was also making more money and my business was also doing far better.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, it's really, you know, I think it was Henry Ford actually sort of way back in the day who sort of basically argued that, you know, you need to pay people a decent wage in order for them to buy his cars. And I think that's sort of the same, you know, sort of very common sense principle that we're dealing with right here. I mean, you know, I don't want to bankrupt the country in order to make an extra, you know, a couple of $1,000 by lowering my taxes. I want to prosper. I want my business to grow. I want to be able to hire more people so that, you know, basically the entire pie grows bigger. So it's not just kind of, you know, what's in it for me. It's, you know, hopefully what's in it for, you know, the broader society.
Indeed. I think your point that we're talking about what kind of society we want to live in, I don't understand folks that think that as long as they're doing okay at the top of the heap, it doesn't matter what's happening down below. I don't understand why that doesn't affect them.
Well, I think, you know, some people have argued that there's, you know, class warfare going on when they sort of the whole issue of taxes gets raised, and there certainly is class warfare going on, and it's me and my sort of, you know, income class against the rest of you, and I'm winning. You know, that's sort of a thing that sort of other people should really sort of wake up and recognize, and it seems like, you know, I think it's actually a lot of people do recognize this, and it's sort of some people in the media, you know, a lot of people in the financial services industry, you know, basically sort of the super rich, you know, sort of hedge fund managers who, you know, for some reason have no conscience, but, you know.
Yeah, making $1 million a day or something, yeah.
Right,
totally
right.
Totally outrageous.
I make north of $250,000 a year, but like, you know, I don't have, you know, indentured servants and Oompa Loompas or something like that. But, you know, but I think that's a different, you know.
Well, you're using the metaphor about the class warfare. My point was that there are no winners when there is this kind of warfare, that the rich, I don't understand how they think that this they're not going to get any on them, if you know what I mean. That is,
well, yeah, that, I mean, I see your point.
That it's a win to have the majority of people in the country suffering. I don't see how they win then.
Well, I think they win in the short term, but what I think is just sort of extraordinarily short-sighted. I think they're weakening the country. I think they're weakening their own economic position, but it's, you know, you need to have a little bit of foresight, which, you know, oddly enough, a lot of these people don't seem to have. So, you know, it's just unfortunate.
Okay, and one last question for you, sir. You're listening to Jeff Hayes, president of Stratalis Research, a member of Wealth for the Common Good, put out a press release. Millionaires urge Congress to reject compromise on Bush tax cuts for rich. What kind of response are you getting to this urging that you're doing?
You know, I think it's very, you know, positive response. I mean, I think the membership is, you know, is sort of galvanized by, you know, kind of the debate, which is obviously very hot right now. And, you know, I mean, it's, as we said at the beginning, I mean, I think people like me are swimming upstream, but we're still swimming. We're trying to swim as hard as we can.
Amen. I thank you so much for joining us. Folks can go to wealthforcommongood.org to find out more information about Jeff's organization. Meanwhile, we're going to be opening the phones to you all, and we've got Maria Friess with the National Committee to Preserve Social Security still on the phone with us, and Jason Rosenbaum with the Progressive Change Campaign Committee, and we're going to be coming back to them, but I wanted to give a little bit of the other side, or actually the side you've been hearing. We started out with Mr. Obama, so here is Barney Frank, a representative from Vermont.
communities that I represent that are going to have to lay off firefighters and public works employees and police officers because the Republicans say, oh, well, you can't do anything to exacerbate the deficit. And the biggest single thing we're going to do that's deficit exacerbating now, that's in controversy, is to give a tax increase to the wealthiest people in the country. And I do not believe that raising the marginal rate from 36 to 39% on hundreds of thousands of dollars is going to affect their spending patterns. Let's be clear. A majority of the Senate voted to not allow people making millions of dollars to get a reduction from what is currently scheduled under taxes. And let's throw in the estate tax where they were too soft as well. I don't think it was preordained that if we had a deadlock that they would have won it. Yeah, we tried to do it. They couldn't win theirs. The Democrats got 53 votes in the Senate, but they got 36. So the argument, well, we only got 53 votes, we can't do it. Well, they only got 36 votes. Since when did 36 have more moral authority than 53? No, I won't vote for it. I believe, and I certainly was honest about this in the campaign I ran, that it would do no economic damage if you had that fairly small increase, less than 10% in the income above $250,000 to the economy, and it would be better. By the way, I will say there's one thing I find a little bit of a silver lining here. I like the fact that it's only for 2 years, because those arguing for this reduction from what the law would currently call for have said, oh, well, you can't tax millionaires at this level during a recession. Well, 2 years from now, when this comes up again, we won't be in a recession, clearly. And I will make a prediction to you now. They'll be just as opposed to taxing in a fair way as they were today. That is, this argument about a recession is pure cover. That's not their real reason. And when we take this up in 2 years and we're not in a recession, you're going to hear the same kind of resistance to putting the rate back to where it was during that very successful economy under Bill Clinton. But the fact is that once you agree that we should have some short-term stimulus, which the Republicans have said we should not have, then there are more effective ways to do it than giving Warren Buffett and Bill Gates tax breaks, which to the credit of Warren Buffett and Bill Gates, they have asked us not to give them.
Is it going to pass?
I'm afraid that it is, yes.
Barney Frank, Chairman of the House Financial Services Committee, thank you very much.
You're
Thanks,
welcome.
Barney. And, in fact, that was a clip from MSNBC and Barney Frank, of course. So right now we're going to be opening the phones at 510-848-4425. But first I want to turn to our guests on the phone, Maria Fries and Jason Rosenbaum. Jason, besides the ad that you guys are putting up, what can everyone's saying that this is going to pass? And even Maria says, oh, well, you know, we'll have to come back at it. If it's going to be harder later, why are we going to come back at it later? I don't get this part.
Well, I mean, I don't know who can believe the president at this point when he says 2 years from now, I'm going to fight to let these things end. I mean, he campaigned on this and then he threw that overboard when the going got tough instead of actually, you know, fighting. But I disagree that this is a, you know, preordained conclusion. I think we've seen some surprising things in the last couple of days. And I think, you know, from what I've heard from folks in the House and in the Senate, they're getting tons and tons of calls from regular Americans on this. I've been told that they're running even at levels that approach the number of calls they were getting around the TARP vote, around the bailout vote. And now, you know, the House and Senate did go ahead with that bailout.
Yes, they did.
a lot of members these days feel that that was the wrong vote to take. So I'm not sure that these calls, you know, these calls very well may be listened to if they are really reaching those levels. They've been overwhelmingly running opposed to this deal. You know, just over the last couple days, over at boldprogressives.org, we put in over 10,000 calls to Congress over the last couple days. We'll be doing more of that. And that stuff really helps. And you saw what happened in the House today, where House Democrats in their caucus meeting, they said, we're not going to vote for it. And reports, we're not even going to bring it up for a vote. And reports say that that decision was largely unanimous. So I don't know if this is a foreordained conclusion yet.
Well, then we've got the New York Times in the op-ed, in their editorial today, and in my favorite op-ed writer, Gail Collins, both saying, let's see, what does it say? Democrats should vote for this deal because it's the only one they are going to get. Without this bargain, income taxes on the middle class will rise. Unemployment insurance will expire. Many other important tax breaks for low and middle income workers, including the payroll tax cut, which we already have debunked, would not be possible. If angry Democrats blow up the deal, they will be left vainly groping for something better in a new Congress where they will have far less influence than they have now. The middle class and the unemployed will be seriously hurt. Let's hear what listeners have to say about this. Who do you believe? 510-848-4425. I started giving the call-in number. It's like automatically chiseled on my brain. I think Craig in San Leandro is first. Go right ahead.
Thanks for taking my call. It's a good show. Thinking about this issue, I think we really need to have a permanent campaign on this issue, not just when tax reform comes up. And I was thinking that, maybe there should be some sort of a TV series or video documentary project of the lives of the rich and famous who support tax reform. I mean, there are a lot of people out there who are members of the elites. We talked about Bill Gates' father and Warren Buffett, but there are a lot of people out there who are celebrities, and we need to educate
That's
the
right.
public on this issue. And if somebody is making a lot of money and they believe in social investment, then God bless them, because they're taking a perspective that all of the elites should take. And unfortunately, they badmouth liberal elites, but on this issue, they can really show that they're, pretty compassionate people. But I'd like to see some sort of TV series or something on the lives of rich and famous people who support tax reform.
All right. I thank you very much. Conrad in Berkeley, welcome to Living Room.
First of all, the process issue is that progressives are never going to get anywhere until we have an effective voice in the mass media. So we have to push real hard there. Secondly, the thing that I'm not hearing talked about hardly at all is the overall strategy that's global, including Democrats and Republicans, as a result of the financial debacle bubble and all that, is that their solution that they're coming up with is an austerity program. So, in other words, don't create any kind of stimulus and cut every possible social program in order to fulfill some weird philosophical concept. So this debate needs to be thoroughly understood what's going on here, so that people don't get distracted in the details of the day-to-day squabble and look at, they're leading us down a path that is not going to be good. It's bad already, but if we let them get away with this, this is going to be terrible.
Amen. That is how I feel about it. It feels very doom and gloom. Jason, have you any cheer on that regard, if we let them get away with it, Conrad said?
I think the point the caller made was right, in the sense that this isn't limited to the U.S., that you're seeing all these pushes for a so-called austerity in all kinds of other countries. Ireland, you had riots in Britain today. You see Greece, all these other countries, and it's the same way, and it's bad economics. If consumer spending is down, if businesses are less willing to invest or hire, then government needs to spend money to make up that difference. It's basic Keynesian economics. It works. Now you're seeing governments turn away from that, and that's going to be a real big problem, globally, not just here. It's up to us to stand up for that and, stand up against that and make sure our representatives and our senators stand up against that, too. I think having a president who is willing to, cut a deal on a core principle is not helpful. But I don't think that this is the end. There are changes that can be made. It doesn't necessarily have to pass. The clock is ticking. So, we're going to have to see what happens. But if folks are mad and if folks don't think this is the way to go, then they need to get involved.
All right. I'm going to snag another caller here because he's calling from Chicago, my hometown. Habu in Chicago, welcome to you.
Nope, it's Norma. You got the wrong person. You want it?
If we can get Habu. Oh, he's gone.
Oh,
I'm so sorry. Anyway, Norma, not that we're not helping.
Yeah,
happy
to
hear from you. Go right ahead.
I just wanted to put in what we all know, and that is that all of this is predicated on this abortive kind of behavior of consuming stuff that brutalizes workers and earth. We have to buy stuff. We have to make stuff and buy stuff. This is irrational, as we all know. The way we're living has no relevance to the fact that we're here on earth together. And also, this is ignoring that what is really the basis of this so-called economy, you know, they separate economy from social and political, and it's really a holy trinity, W-H-O-L-L-Y. It's all one thing. Anyway, it's all based on war. I mean, if we don't have wars and military, we don't have any economy. And this is all called Keynesian militarism, if people get a chance to read it, especially in Monthly Review, how the substance is based on, that's where the consumption is guaranteed. You know, you drop a bomb, you have to make another one.
All right. I thank you for that perspective. That's always helpful. Carmen in San Mateo, welcome to Living Room.
Thank you. No, if they do not pass this tax initiative and let them all expire, can the president pass an emergency unemployment?
That's a good question. Maria, would you have any information on that about what would...
Unfortunately, he can't, or he would have done it already, I suspect, and that's part of the problem. But one of the things that I think your listeners need to understand, there's been a little bit of, lack of clarity about the unemployment provisions that are actually in this proposal. Now, we don't handle unemployment. We do Social Security and Medicare, so this is not my forte. But my understanding of what's in this bill is not an additional time period beyond the 99 weeks that are already part of the statute. So those people that have already exhausted their benefits, that are currently in the process of losing their checks, they're going to get nothing out of this bill if it is enacted. The only thing that's in here is an extension of the current 99-week time period. So if you are relatively newly unemployed, then you will have the opportunity to get to 99 weeks if this is passed. But if you're already a long-term unemployed person and you've used up your 99 weeks, you get zippo out of this bill.
Wow.
And that has not been made very clear to a lot of people, I don't think. People have been left with the impression that these people that are getting cut off right now because they've used up their 99 weeks are suddenly going to keep getting checks if this is enacted. My understanding is that's not the way it's going to work. So, and in terms of the Social Security provisions, I mean, part of our challenge is that Social Security is a complicated topic in terms of what it means to people. There are billions of dollars that have been spent over the last decade or two to try to convince people that Social Security is bankrupt, that it's in trouble, that it needs to be, that young people aren't going to get it. People have walked into this debate thinking that the program's in trouble anyway, and therefore we just need to salvage what we can out of it. And that's not true. But our side doesn't have $1 billion dedicated to cutting Social Security like Pete Peterson has put into his foundation. He created his own news service, the Financial Times, so that he could get the word out. I mean, $1 billion buys you a lot of publicity. And the progressive side doesn't seem to have those kinds of resources focused on, certainly not on our programs, because there are so many needs out there, they get divided all over the place. The other thing that I just wanted to make sure I mentioned is we also have a website. And for people who are interested in this and want to learn more about both Social Security and Medicare, absolutely, I urge them to look at our website. We have a blog, we have Facebook, we have Twitter, we have all those things. And part of what we're trying to do is raise awareness about what the consequences to Social Security and Medicare are of all of these deficit reduction things that are going on right now. Our website, it's our initials, www.ncpssm.org, but the easiest way to get to us is thenationalcommittee.org. And I strongly recommend to people that they check us out and sign up our Facebook page, get engaged, because, you know, the callers are absolutely right. If people don't stand up to protect these programs, they're going to be gone.
Maria Freese, our guest, with the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare. That's where the M comes from. I haven't been saying that part. The National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare, nationalcommittee.org or ncpssm.org. And she has, she's currently Director of Government Relations and Policy. And in fact, she's done a great deal of hands-on work in Congress. She's served as legislative assistants and directors for several representatives, including Max Baucus. She was also Democratic tax counsel for the Senate Finance Committee. She's done a lot about estate taxes, and I know that that's on here as well. And that's something that, say a few words about that. I know that you're focused on Social Security, but you have some understanding, obviously, of what else is in there. What was the estate tax connection?
Well, you know, the estate tax provisions were such a huge win for the Republicans. I cannot tell you. If Congress had done nothing, as you know, because of the way that the law was structured, the original Bush tax cut provisions, this year there was no estate tax. But starting January 1, the law would have sprung back to what it was before the Bush tax cuts, again, during the Clinton years, which would have been about $1 million exemption per individual and a couple, you know, per spouse, and a top rate of about 55%. But again, it's a graduated rate. There are a lot of exemptions. The last rate was before the repeal was a $3.5 million rate per person. I mean, exclusion per person with a 45% rate. What they got in this bill was $5 million per spouse exclusion that is not counted at all, not subject to an estate tax at all, and then a 35% rate for amounts after that. Hundreds of billions of dollars worth of revenue lost through the estate tax that by definition only applies to millionaires. Even if you let the original go back into place, you're not touching any money under $1 million per spouse. And yet, that wasn't enough for the Republicans, and they insisted on going to this alternative, which now means that if you're a couple, the estate tax doesn't begin to touch you until you have over $10 million in assets.
Which I feel so relieved.
Oh, yeah. In this deficit environment, I just think, frankly, I don't even know how to characterize it, how bad it is. It's just inexcusable. And if you look at the Republicans with a very straight face, they can talk about cutting spending. They were actually talking about offering amendments on the Senate side. I don't know what happened with this, to try to make sure that this paltry little unemployment tax unemployment benefit extension was paid for by more spending cuts. Yet they have no qualms at all about doing $1 trillion worth of tax cuts without even thinking twice about paying for any of it. So it's very one-sided. This concern about the deficit on their part is just crocodile tears. This is all about shrinking the size of the government so that it is left to do nothing but wage war, and that's pretty much it, because most of these people don't think the government has any role in our society, and the more they can cut it back, the better, and they will do it any way they can. And right now, it's the deficit that's giving them their excuse.
Maria Freese, you go. Nationalcommittee.org. I'm going to snag Peggy in Sebastopol on the phone.
Yes, yes. Yes, I agree. Hurrah for the National Committee for Social Security. Couple quick things. On the estate tax, the New York Times editorial a couple days ago said, I'm pretty much quoting, it said, on that point, it was an editorial criticizing Obama's acceptance of the tax cuts for the rich. But on that point, it said, on the estate tax, this was not a compromise. This was a capitulation. And I think that's not good at all. The other thing I want to say is, what's interesting to me is this revolt in the House by the Democrats. You know, after the election, I was looking at it and I was saying, yeah, the progressives in Democrats in Congress are much stronger now proportionally within their own party. And I think we're seeing that. I think what we're seeing now is a progressive Democratic voice. Admittedly, it's going to be in the minority in toto, but within the party, hey, it's much stronger. So you know, given that fact, and given the fact that every call is counted, I would say it's a good time to be calling your congresspeople.
All right. Jason, do you agree with that?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I mean, calls are running at record numbers. You know, we've been crashing the phone lines over the last couple days.
What about Peggy's point about there are more progressives in the Democratic caucus than there were before the election?
Well, that's true, though. The current House makeup is the same as it was before the election. We haven't had the changeover yet. That won't happen until January 3rd or whenever it is. But, you know, I even think some of the more conservative members of the Democratic caucus are not for this either. You know, I mean, I'm taking to heart what was reported, I believe it was in roll call, that this decision to not hold a vote, this rebellion, was virtually unanimous. So that's everybody from all corners of the Democratic Party.
Wow. One last caller I think we've got time for, Jesse in Petaluma.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just don't get it. It seems like the stupid ray is working.
Yeah.
In my world, 2 + 2 = 4. In America, that's not the case. Everyone's dealing in these concepts and not dealing with the facts of the numbers. How much is Social Security down? Is that a fact? What is quantitative easing? Do people understand what that is? Just understand the numbers. If your mortgage, you got to pay it. People understand that. Can't they understand politics in the same way with numbers?
Well, sir, on that rhetorical note, I thank you for calling and all of the callers. And Maria Friis with the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare, and Jason Rosenbaum with the Progressive Change Campaign Committee. And you guys are at boldprogressives.org. You can go to nationalcommittee.org for more information. And this is what this is all about. What that last caller said is about education, and that's what Maria, you said that we all had to do more of. So I
absolutely.
I hope that we did a little bit of it today. It's not a pretty picture, that's for sure.
But you shouldn't get discouraged, and the only way to turn it around is to get involved.
Amen. Maria Friis, thank you so much for joining us. Final words from you, Jason.
Get involved. I think you said it absolutely. Folks need to pick up the phone.
All right. Thank you so much. And thank you all for picking up the phone and joining the conversation today and for listening. And big ups to Gary Baca at the controls. I want to say that tonight in San Francisco at the Redstone Building, which is on 16th Street, 2940 16th Street, the Global Women's Strike and Women of Color in the Global Women's Strike are presenting a film premiere of San Francisco of Give Us Back Our Children, Mothers and Others Reclaim Children from the Child Welfare Industry, followed by a community dialogue on the criminalization of survival, budget cuts, child welfare, and poverty. So check that out tonight, 7 o'clock, 2940 16th Street, 2940 16th Street, near the 16th Street BART, the Redstone Building, room 301. Thanks again for listening.
KPFA team for our largest, most exciting annual off-air event, the KPFA Crafts Fair. We need friendly and reliable volunteers to help at the door and to assist exhibitors and visitors at the fair. On Friday, December 10th, we welcome assistance in setting up from 9 a.m. to 9 p.m. On Saturday, December 11th, we need help from 6:45 a.m. through 6:30 p.m. And on Sunday, December 12th, from 8 a.m. through 9 p.m. This event takes place at the Concourse Exhibition Center at 8th and Brannan in San Francisco, and it's a great opportunity for you to attend as KPFA's guest, and thanks for working a 3-hour shift at the fair. If you'd like to pitch in and sign up for a shift, call Mickey at 510-848-6767, extension 646, or email volunteer@kpfa.org. As always, we appreciate your help and hope to see you there.
Time is shortly before 1 p.m., and you tune to KPFA and KPFB Berkeley, online at kpfa.org. Please stay tuned for the Herbal Highway with your host, Karen.